The following Dharma talk was recorded in January 2015 near Kansas City, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the annual New Year's retreat taught by Robert Brummett. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Robert Brummett has practiced insight meditation since 1988 and conducted retreats since 1995. He received a Vipassana facilitator training from Shinzen Young and graduated from the Spirit Rock Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Robert is one of the founding members of Mid-America Dharma. He lives in Kansas City and teaches at Unity Institute and Seminary near Lee's Summit, Missouri.
I want to talk a little bit about some supports for integrating this practice into your everyday life. It's very good to come to retreats, but if that's all we did was do the practice at retreats and not in our everyday life, it would be of relatively little value to us. The whole idea is that we are kind of like sharpening the knife so that we can cut vegetables or cut bread or whatever in our everyday life, you know. And if we just did nothing but sharpen the knife and never use it, it would be of little practical value. So I have what I call six pillars, if you will. Six supports for carrying the practice into your everyday life that I'd like to share with you. And the first two pillars, the first two supports, have to do with our sitting practice. And the first one is very simple to explain, and basically it's just do it. Do it every day. Have a sitting practice every day. And ideally at the same time every day, so that you're making it part of your routine, just as much as eating or brushing your teeth or taking a shower or whatever. So that it's not something you do if you get around to it or if you have enough time, that you sit at the same time every day or as nearly as possible the same time every day. Now, the obvious question is, for how long should I sit? And the answer is, that depends a lot on how much time you have available, what your schedule is. If you can sit for an hour or for 45 minutes, that would be great. But if you have only 5 or 10 minutes available, that's still much, much better than not at all. So the thing is to do it. And Joseph Goldstein says, if all you do is put your tush on the cush just for 1 minute, at least you're acknowledging your practice. Because intention is a very important part of this practice. And what we do when we sit, even if it's just for a few minutes, is we're reinforcing that intention to stay awake, to awaken. And again, if you can do it much longer than 5 minutes, That's certainly much, much better. But please don't ever say, I'm too busy to sit. You know, anybody has 5 minutes to sit. If you're too busy to eat, you know, I don't think anybody's ever been too busy to eat. And so make it a priority. And in your sitting practice, I mean, do whatever works for you. The simplest thing is just what we've been doing here. You know, be aware of the posture. Bring attention to the breath. That may be enough. If you want to open up to body sensations, that's okay too. Generally speaking, in a short daily sit, I would not recommend trying to watch thinking or get too involved in mental states, because especially in the morning if we're getting ready for our day, it's usually much better to focus on concentrating and just stilling the mind and stabilizing the mind, coming home to the breath, coming home to the body. But again, whatever works for you is what works for you. So you can experiment with it a little bit. But again, I just want to underscore the point that a daily sitting practice is absolutely crucial. A second part, a second pillar that supports the sitting practice is to, if at all possible, be part of a sangha. Sangha is a community of yogis, of practitioners, meditators. And there's no special way that community has to look. It can be just you and one or two other people. That's a sangha. It can be a formal sangha with a teacher, or it can be yourself and just a small group of friends. The important thing is that you're forming the community and that you're coming together specifically to support one another in your practice. That's what's really crucial. So it's not a coffee clatch. It's not a social thing. It's not a discussion group. You're coming together to support your practice. So the most important thing is that you come together and you sit. Sit for 30 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever. And then if you want to discuss a book, or listen to a CD, or watch a DVD, or a podcast, or something like that. Why, that can be helpful. If you want to socialize before or after, you know, if they're personal friends and you want to do that, that's great. But the point is, the sangha should be structured just for the purpose of supporting the practice itself, and not diluted with something else. Kind of like a 12-step meeting, if you will, you know, if you're familiar with that. There's kind of a set format that they adhere to, and it's really helpful to do that because it creates that support for the practice. Mid-America Dharma is available to help you find a sangha or to help you start a sangha. If there's any way I can support you in finding a sangha or starting a sangha, I'm certainly happy to do that. One of the nice things today is there is a lot of support for the practice today in regard to meditation groups, in regards to books, in regards to teachers and teachings, you know. So the next two pillars are about bringing your practice into your everyday life. And so pillar number three has to do with practicing the precepts, the five ethical precepts. And basically, the precepts are ethical guidelines that are used to support the practice. So I want to really emphasize that you don't see these as commandments or rules. That's not at all their intention. It's not about being good or about not sinning, okay? If that's your background, this is not where we're coming from. But it's a way of supporting your practice by following ethical guidelines. And the underlying ethical guideline is to do no harm. To do no harm. Specifically, the five precepts to do no harm by killing or injuring another being. To do no harm by taking what is not given to one. To do no harm through sexual misconduct. To do no harm through our speech. To speak only what is true, what is kind, and what is charitable, and what is necessary. And to not misuse intoxicants. to not cloud the mind through the use or the misuse of intoxicants. So it's basically doing no harm in all the various arenas of our life regarding the way we relate to others, the way we relate to the world in general, the way we relate to our own body. And I find the most helpful way to use the precepts is not to see them as something I should do or shouldn't do, but when I find myself violating a precept or considering or thinking about it, violating a precept, then take a deep breath. What's going on within me? You know, if I find myself inclined, for example, to gossip or to badmouth somebody, you know, okay, let's find out what's happening here. You say there's some anger, there's some hurt, there's something going on that needs my attention. So the ethical guidelines to me are kind of like, you know, the rumble strips on the side of a highway. You know, you're kind of driving along and you space out a little bit and all of a sudden you hear rum, bum, 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 you know. Okay. So if you can use the ethical precepts in that way of, ooh, what's going on here, you know? I mean, even something like swatting a fly, you know, what's the energy there? I mean, it's not about should I or shouldn't I kill flies. I mean, that's not the point. The point is, what's the energy behind that, you see? We have this reactivity that says anything that annoys me deserves to be destroyed. You know, if a mosquito bites me or if a fly lands on my body, why, automatically I want to maybe kill it or something, you see. Just notice that. Because the way we respond to anything is the way we typically respond to everything, you see. So the way we respond to a mosquito or a fly is also the way we respond, at least internally, to anything or anyone that annoys us or bothers us, you see. So these are all ways of supporting the mindfulness practice. And of course, there is the objective sense of simply being kind and helpful to other people, which is part of the practice as well. So that's the third pillar. The fourth pillar in regard to carrying the practice into your everyday life is to have some kind of a plan or a strategy of how you will bring mindfulness into your everyday life. What doesn't work, I found out, is to wake up in the morning and say, I resolve to be mindful today. And then, typically, when I'm going to bed, I'll say, what was that I was going to do today? Oh, yeah, I was going to be mindful. I forget all about that. See? So see if you can be more specific. And some of the ways of doing that is to have certain times of the day when you focus more on mindfulness practice. And what I often recommend is the first hour of the day or the first part of the day. Most of the time, the first hour of the day, we're doing things that are relatively simple, relatively routine. Oftentimes, we're by ourselves. We're not involved in any complex intellectual or emotional interactions, typically. So it's an opportunity to bring awareness to the simple activities of showering and brushing our teeth and getting dressed and so forth. So anytime we're doing something relatively simple, relatively routine, relatively repetitive, that's a great opportunity for the practice. You know, cleaning the house or washing the dishes or something like that. Driving the car. You know, helpful to be mindful while we're driving. And So that's one way to do it, is certain times of the day, or again, certain activities. When you go to the grocery store, it's a great time to practice mindfulness, you know. You can be intentional on what you're shopping for, but you can also be mindful while you're doing it, you see, while you're waiting in line, banking, and so on and so forth. It's interesting how much of our day is spent in relatively routine activities, and sometimes it's in just waiting, you see. And that time typically is used in, you know, getting lost in our internal chatter and our whatever the story du jour is, you know, that's what's going on up here, you see. So it's a great time to do the mindfulness practices in those times of routine activity. Other possibilities, certain triggers. You can use certain things as a trigger for the practice. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, whenever you hear a phone ring or whenever you hear a bell, let that be a mindfulness bell. You know, one way. Teacher Gurdjieff used to say, every time you walk through a door, stop for a moment. That can be an opportunity. I find any time I reach for a door handle or open a door, that can be. Just stop for just a microsecond. Take a deep breath. Be mindful. Somebody I know says she says every time she sees the color red, that's a reminder. You know, every time you see a yellow truck, whatever, you know. but there are ways of reminding ourselves of the practice. There's even apps for phones now that will chime or ding or whatever, you know, to remind you to do the practice. So staying awake during the day. Another way is to maintain mindfulness to a certain part of the body throughout the day. You know, some practices say be aware of your arms and legs at all times. Or what I typically will do is if I'm standing or walking, I put my awareness on my feet. If I'm sitting, I put my awareness on my hands. So if we're connected with the body, we're connected with the present moment. So that's pillar number four. Finding a strategy for staying present in your everyday life. And the next two pillars have to do with maintaining the practice. And one of those is attending retreats periodically. You know, how and when you can do that depends a lot on your lifestyle and finances and relationships and a whole lot of other things. But to the extent that you can, it's very helpful to attend retreats on a regular basis. I'd say at least once a year and two or three times a year if you could do it. And again, the longer retreats, the longer the better in general. You may have noticed at this retreat, you know, we've been together about 4 days, and it took a couple of days to really get here, to really let the momentum of the old life kind of wind down. And so it seemed like it was well into Saturday by the time we really kind of landed, and I could feel the energy shifting, you see. So if you can do a retreat that's 3 days or longer, why that, but even a 1 or 2 days is helpful. And the sixth pillar is, I'll put it under the label of education, which consists of books, reading books, listening to CDs or podcasts, teachers' teachings. And again, today the good news is that there's a plethora of opportunities, both in terms of teachers' teachings and media available. Back when I first started the practice, if I found a book on insight meditation, I'd call a bunch of people and say, hey, I discovered this book, really a find, And of course today there's dozens and dozens of books written on insight meditation. And there's all sorts of ways that we can receive instruction. So that's the good news. So yeah, going online, buying books, listening to recorded material is extremely helpful. Oftentimes people ask me about teachers or teachings. And generally speaking, I'd say whoever, whatever works for you. In this particular tradition, once again, the sort of the patriarchs and matriarchs are Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and people that they've taught. But there are many good teachers and teachings and books. Pema Chodron is very popular, and I highly recommend her books and her work. Thich Nhat Hanh, of course, and many, many others. There's a website called Dharma Seed, dharmaseed.org, is it? dharmaseed.org. And there are at least a gazillion Dharma talks on Dharma Seed. And there are scores and scores of teachers. You can go in, you can search by teacher, you can search by topic, you can search by particular retreat. So we are really blessed. I mean, it's just really, again, I think one of the virtues of being of a generation that has spanned a number of decades is I can remember way back when these teachings were so rare, and the teachings that some people would make a pilgrimage to India to hear, we can get this way at all. And so it's very important that we not be too blasé about that and really appreciate that there is an incredible depth of wisdom available to us today. And we are really, really blessed and gifted for that to happen. So I encourage you to make use of that. Mid-America Dharma has Dharma Talks on its website. My Sangha, unitysangha.org, has Dharma Talks that I've given. I have a website, robertbrummett.com, that has a twice-a-month blog on it. You can subscribe to the blog if you wish. So the blog basically consists of a little mini Dharma talk. And again, there's many, many different opportunities for books, websites, for teachings, for teachers. And you could spend half an hour surfing the web and find enough to keep you busy for the rest of your life. The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The practice. The community that supports the practice. And then, of course, the ultimate intention of the practice is to be the Buddha. So I think I'll stop at this point and just take some questions.